In a split decision yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down restrictions on Louisiana abortion clinics. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Louisiana law before the high court required doctors who perform abortions to have hospital admitting privileges within 30 miles of the clinic they perform their abortions. We will break down the decision and what it means with your thoughts along the way on this ruling at 800-642-1234. Mary Ziegler is here. She's a professor at Florida State University College of Law, author of Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So this was a 5-4 decision with four liberal justices writing a separate opinion from Chief Justice John Roberts. How did the justices interpret this case?
Well, I think one of the interesting things, or probably the most striking thing, is that we were not sure going into June Medical if we just had a solid conservative majority that would always vote to uphold abortion restrictions, or if the fate of abortion rights in America was up for grabs. And it turns out that the latter possibility is true, and that John Roberts is that new swing justice. The majority, or was actually a plurality of the court, the four liberal justices, emphasized that there was no evidence that this law helped anyone. In other words, that admitting privileges served any useful purpose, and that there was considerable evidence that the law would force the closure of all but one clinic in Louisiana. Interestingly, Roberts didn't seem particularly persuaded by any of that and was quite openly skeptical about abortion rights. He noted that if this was the court was working with a blank slate and this was the first time they heard this case, he would have voted to uphold the law. And in fact, he did just that in 2016. So Roberts' opinion was much more about his respect for precedent and his concern about the court's legacy than it was about his support for abortion rights.
Yeah, because of
lots of uncertainty going forward. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, looking at this precedence, because this suit mirrored the case in Texas, literally almost word for word, that the court had struck down in 2016. Did we learn anything from this case on where the court is headed on abortion and Roe?
We learned some things, but I think it's still kind of ambiguous, right? I think on the one hand, Roberts feels bound by precedent. And of course, Roe v. Wade is a precedent too. If anything, it's more of a precedent. It's been around for almost 50 years at this point. On the other hand, Roberts seems pretty skeptical about abortion rights and pretty committed to an approach to abortion regulations that would give states more room to restrict access. So I think one thing we know for sure is that the kind of really fast pace of change we saw in 2019 with states trying to ban abortion at fertilization seems likely to backfire. And that if the Supreme Court is going to overturn Roe, it's going to take time and patience on the part of abortion opponents, which is something they don't seem to have a lot of, especially after several setbacks this Supreme Court term already.
What did the defenders of the Louisiana restrictions argue in this case?
Well, there were two main arguments that Louisiana made in the case. The first was that Louisiana is different from Texas, essentially that the problems the Supreme Court had spotted in Texas 4 years ago in striking down that state's law didn't apply to Louisiana, that Louisiana doctors would have an easier time getting admitting privileges and staying open, and that the burden on women would be less onerous. Louisiana also, I think, invited the court, at least implicitly, to gut its 2016 decision and to show in doing that that it wasn't particularly concerned about its past precedents on abortion, at least not after Brett Kavanaugh joined the court. Louisiana made another argument, which was that abortion doctors shouldn't even be able to sue in the first place. They are allowed now to sue on behalf of their patients on the theory that patients face obstacles to bringing lawsuits on their own behalf. Louisiana argued that that was sort of tantamount to the fox guarding the hen house because abortion is bad for women and abortion providers don't care about their patients. The Supreme Court didn't buy that either, really any of those arguments. But again, it really boiled down to Roberts' respect for precedent more than anything else.
Yeah, because you told us in April that this case is also about who can bring a suit, who can challenge the constitutionality of abortion laws and whether abortion providers can sue. What does that tell us about how abortion law is being argued in America?
Well, I think that there's a lot of reasons that abortion opponents focused on these arguments that abortion hurts women. And the most, I think there are two probably that are the most central. The first is that the anti-abortion movement has long sort of had an image problem when it comes to women, especially in the years when you saw more attacks on abortion clinics and even murders of abortion doctors. Focusing on arguments about women helped to kind of create a softer image and to appeal to women within the anti-abortion movement who believed that abortion was in fact harmful. Second, I think that many believe that it was a necessary step if anyone really wished to see Roe overturned. Many leaders of the anti-abortion movement believe that Americans will never tolerate the reversal of Roe if they think that women need access to abortion to achieve equal citizenship. So a necessary precursor to overruling Roe is showing that that's wrong and that abortion is in fact harmful to women. But we've seen from the Supreme Court that while that might be a necessary step, it's going to be very hard to win with that argument, at least with the kinds of laws the Supreme Court has already seen.
We're discussing yesterday's Supreme Court ruling on abortion with Mary Ziegler as our guide. She's a professor at Florida State University College of Law, and you can join in. Do you think there could be a compromise on abortion, or is this an issue that doesn't leave for any room for compromise? What did you see out of yesterday's ruling? How have you talked with family members and friends about abortion rights and anti-abortion groups? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mary, during the pandemic, some states have moved to ban abortion by designating it a non-essential service. And when we last talked, you had said you were seeing momentum. Is this still playing out around the country?
Not as much as when we last spoke. And the simple reason for that is just which states are reopening the most quickly. So generally, it's pretty red states that were passing these COVID-19 abortion bans. And it's also pretty red states that were the fastest to reopen. And of course, what the justification for banning abortion had been the elimination of what were considered non-essential medical services. That, of course, isn't necessarily going to remain the case because we've seen cases surge in Florida, unfortunately, where I live, as well as in Texas. And Texas, of course, was one of the main proponents of a COVID-19 abortion ban. So depending on how bad things get in Texas, we may see more closures. And if we see more closures, we may see the reemergence of COVID-19 abortion bans. But they've been paused for now.
And we were seeing also reports of women having to cross state lines as services non-essential, being deemed non-essential services. They were being shut down and therefore, that limiting access to these clinics.
Right. And I mean, we've seen that will probably continue if states do in fact shut down clinics. It's worth noting that even without COVID-19 abortion bans, of course, states have enough restrictions that there are very few clinics in states like Mississippi and Louisiana, independently of what the Supreme Court did yesterday. So even in the absence of a COVID-19 abortion ban, there are almost certainly women crossing state lines to get abortions.
Mary Ziegler, professor at Florida State University College of Law. She researches abortion law and reproductive history. She's giving us some context into yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision striking down a Louisiana abortion law. How do you feel about the ruling now? Can there be a compromise? Can there be common ground on this issue? Be part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Mary Ziegler here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court split decision that came down yesterday. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The High Court struck down a Louisiana law that could have left the state with one abortion clinic. The closely watched case could have reshaped abortion laws across the nation, but Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's liberal justices to uphold precedents. Have you been anticipating this ruling? What are your thoughts on the state of the abortion debate today? Is it more polarized? What is the future of Roe v. Wade? We're at 800-642-1234. We have Mary Ziegler with us, a professor at Florida State, and her most recent book is called Abortion and the Law in America. Mary, beyond Louisiana, what could this ruling mean for clinics providing abortion services here in Wisconsin or in other states?
Well, I think that it certainly means that the exact kind of law, what are often called trap laws, targeted regulations of abortion providers, those laws are not going to work at the U.S. Supreme Court. And so Wisconsin lawmakers who were invested in that approach are going to have to go back to the drawing board. It doesn't mean necessarily that other abortion restrictions that affect clinics in Wisconsin or affect those on either side of this debate in Wisconsin are going to be unconstitutional. Really what it means, I think in my opinion, is just uncertainty on top of uncertainty. We know that John Roberts now is probably himself doesn't know what he's going to do about Roe v. Wade, but I think it's reasonable to assume that this court will uphold more restrictions down the line. We won't know which ones for some time. So I think the kind of short answer for everyone in Wisconsin is that we all have to stay tuned and that Chief Justice Roberts will keep us guessing.
Julie Rickleman, who argued the case before the court on behalf of the Center for Reproductive Rights, she said yesterday, "We think the opinion muddies the waters a bit and will lead to more litigation rather than less." Why is that?
I think that's quite likely. Roberts' opinion was not crystal clear about where he was going about abortion, and that, of course, will encourage abortion opponents to look for an opening. I think that really, to be fair, though, I think almost any decision from the court would have queued up more litigation. We've seen efforts to dismantle Roe rage on for decades, and I don't think litigation will really slow down, even in the event that the Supreme Court does overturn Roe. So for better or worse, unfortunately, I think this battle is going to be with us for a long time.
Roberts, in his decision, also noted that neither party in June Medical Services in this case had asked the court to revisit Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that 1992 abortion decision. What might have he been noting there?
Well, I'm sorry, you cut out for a minute. Would you mind saying that again?
Yeah, sure. Chief Justice Roberts in his decision noted that neither party in the June case here had asked the court to revisit the Planned Parenthood versus Casey case from 1992. What might he be noting there?
Well, I think that Roberts is probably aware, as many are, that no one knew for sure which way the wind was blowing. It's not entirely true. There were amicus briefs, including one submitted by lawyers at Americans United for Life, which is a group that really was sort of the force behind the Louisiana law, that did ask the court to reverse both Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Roe v. Wade. But I think for the most part, I think abortion opponents understood that that was a stretch and that proceeding more incrementally was the way to go. I think Roberts made pretty clear that that's the only chance abortion opponents have. If there's a blueprint for moving forward, it's going to be a gradual one.
We're discussing yesterday's Supreme Court ruling on abortion with Mary Ziegler. She's a professor at Florida State University College of Law. Let's take a call now. Lori from Shano is not there anymore. So, Mary, let's look more here at Roe versus Wade and the remaining law of the land. What did the decision say about what happens with Roe? I know you're saying stay tuned, but what cases in particular would you see chipping away at Roe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably the most significant cases are ones that could be connected to the court's past precedent, because Roberts has signaled his investment in that idea. And the court's most recent win for the anti-abortion movement was a case called Gonzalez versus Carhart that upheld a federal ban on what was called partial birth abortion. Abortion opponents have lots of cases in the pipeline that try to build on Gonzalez. Some ban abortion at 20 weeks or later on the theory that fetal pain is possible. Others outlawed so-called dismemberment abortion, which is the anti-abortion term for dilation and evacuation, the most common abortion procedure in the after the first trimester of pregnancy. And recently, we've also seen a surge in laws that ban abortions for specific reasons, such as the race, sex, or disability. So I think for all of those, we should expect to see those coming before the court, partly because they either don't ask Roberts to overturn a precedent, or they in fact give him the cover of this being a mere extension of something the Supreme Court has already done. I don't think that's necessarily the best argument. They would be pretty big departures from what the court has done, but there's at least a little bit more political cover for a judge who's concerned about the court's reputation.
Charlene called from Eau Claire, couldn't stay with us, and Charlene says, unfortunately, the attack on Planned Parenthood and abortion is affecting women's health care everywhere, especially minority women. And Charlene says, this isn't just an abortion issue. How does this fold into the overarching look at reproductive health?
Well, I think obviously the attack on Planned Parenthood affects reproductive health in general, and so do many of the laws that you see. Any kind of law that forces the closure of a clinic, like the one the Supreme Court invalidated, will, of course, have effects on access to other reproductive health care as well. That's also true, of course, of COVID-19 abortion bans. Not all abortion restrictions have the same effects, of course, that way. If you're outlawing just a specific procedure or you're outlawing a specific reason for abortion, that has sweeping effects on abortion rights, but may have less effects on providers who are also offering other reproductive health services. But I think in general, the point that when clinics close, it affects access to lots of services, especially for women in rural communities, is a really important one that sometimes gets lost.
So if you are not going after targeted laws, as you've been talking about, in more of these narrow cases, how do you go more broadly in trying to restrict abortion access?
Well, I think you have to be patient if you are an abortion opponent. And there hasn't been much sign of that lately. Donald Trump does not foster patience in either the anti-abortion movement or among conservatives more broadly, right? There's a sort of, you can have what you want right now, and the rules of politics don't apply to Trump, who's managed to overcome scandals that almost certainly would have doomed other leaders. But I think that won't work with the Supreme Court, at least as it's currently constituted. So I think there are kind of two paths forward. One would be to hope that Trump wins re-election in 2020 and is able to nominate someone much more conservative, maybe more than one person who's much more conservative than John Roberts, which would make Roberts' vote irrelevant. The second, I think, would be to buckle down and proceed more gradually and be willing to do this for a matter of years, not a matter of months, and to get much more incremental wins. Because if Roberts is ever going to be comfortable overturning Roe v. Wade, which is still an unknown, he's not going to be comfortable doing it quickly.
What did you see out of how the importance of precedents weighed in on this case and what precedents might have going forward for the integrity of the high court?
Well, I think Roberts certainly joined, I think in some ways did a lot this term to suggest that the Supreme Court is not a partisan institution. And this, of course, has been a great cause of his. Roberts got into a very public tiff with Donald Trump and recently about the idea that there were no Trump judges and no Obama judges. And I think this term he voted with his more liberal colleagues, not only in the abortion case, but also in cases involving DACA and involving LGBTQ plus discrimination. So to some, that will look like the court is not partisan and that at least sometimes Roberts doesn't vote with the conservative justices. To conservatives, it makes Roberts himself look political. They believe that Roberts' votes are about optics and not about the law, And that, in fact, undermines the court's legitimacy. So as you can imagine, most responses to this are coming to us through a very partisan lens, as is true of so many things in America now.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law. She is the author of Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Coming up, two advocates from Madison and Milwaukee share how small businesses are coping with a pandemic. Are you a small business owner? Are you open? What precautions do you have in place? How is your bottom line doing? Join our conversation at 800-642-1234. We'll be back to look at the situation on main streets all over Wisconsin, here in Madison and in Milwaukee. It's coming up right after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're hearing now about how small businesses are coping in this time of economic fallout from the pandemic and recent violent protests over the death of George Floyd. In downtown Madison, walk along State Street and you see business after business with plywood covering their facades. The messages are about systemic racism. Are you a small business owner on a main street in Wisconsin? How have the pandemic and protests affected your business, your livelihood? Are you able to reopen? We're at 800-642-1234. Jason Ilstrup is president of the advocacy organization Downtown Madison, Inc. Jason, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Welcome, Kate. Thank you very much for having me.
Keith Stanley here as well, executive director of Near West Side Partners and Milwaukee's Business Improvement District Number 10, which works to revitalize Milwaukee's Near West Side businesses and neighborhoods. Keith, welcome to you.
Welcome. Good morning.
So, Keith, I'm going to start with you. How are businesses in the Near West Side area of Milwaukee? How are they doing right now?
Well, I would say we still see a lot of challenges for our restaurants and those that depend on like the summer activity. However, there is some silver lining with some of our businesses, some of our grocery stores and those who really provide staples for our community. We're starting to see an uptick in sales and increased product in those stores. So it's sweet and sour for some of our businesses at this time.
Well, can you give us a sense, if we haven't visited this area, what it's like on the Near West Side and, you know, what you see among these businesses? What do they sell?
So we have a wide range. We have over 370 businesses from the big guys like Harley Davidson, Molson Coors, Marquette University. But then we have the smaller folks or mid-size, the Rave Eagles Club, Ambassador Hotel, Daddy's Soul Food Restaurant. And most of our businesses, you know, people say we're west of downtown. Some people sometimes confuse us with downtown, but we're west, just west of downtown. And many of our businesses are looking at ways just to continue with the promotion and still deal with the issues we deal with locally as far as how do we continue to open responsibly. We're not interested in being like what's happening down south. So they are aware, but still struggle.
What about the businesses that you characterize as the new West Side, businesses that are owned by people of color? How are they doing?
I'm glad you brought that up. That has been a focus for us. We are really making sure that they can survive this pandemic, this economic downturn. And so we work closely with some of the city and state officials to get funding for them. But it's been a struggle. I'll give you an example, Daddy's Soul Food Restaurant. They're still going to expand. I think we have an expansion date, but they were planning for a lot bigger affair this summer. And just with the sales as low as they are, they have not been able to do some things they wanted to do this summer. So a lot of our businesses, African-American, Hmong, Asian-owned businesses, they're struggling because the market isn't, it's a difficult time for our businesses.
Are they hanging on, even though they wanted to move forward with their business? Are they still open?
Yes, I have yet to see a business, thank God, close or say they're going to close. We've had some businesses had to lay off 95% of their staff, workforce, just to survive. And so, no one has yet said they're throwing in the towel, which is really good. Once again, it's a hard pill to swallow with what's happening across this country and world, but they're still hanging on in there, and that's a good sign.
Jason, take us to Madison. What is the situation like for small businesses on State Street and the Capitol Square?
Yeah, it's a very difficult situation. If you look at really what the bedrock of any main street, and particularly what we consider to be Wisconsin's main street, Straight Street, many of the bedrock and fundamentals of businesses that are on main streets are struggling, right? Tourism is struggling, retail, restaurants, events are not happening. Nationwide, 8 million people lost their jobs from COVID-19 in the hospitality sector. We've seen a 9% overall decline in retail in the last couple of months. It's the second largest decline in the history of the United States. Restaurant spending down 60%. And what makes it even harder for districts like Keith's and myself is that even though restaurant spending is down 60%, 3 out of every $4 spent in restaurants right now is spent in chains. And so these businesses that we work with, which are so much local, bedrocks of our community, really are struggling to make ends meet. And they're doing everything they can and being as creative as they can to keep their doors open. Many of them are in a mitigation phase right now to really stay open. Unfortunately, I wish I had the same news as Keith, but we've already had a few businesses on State Street that are announcing that they are not going to open back up once everything is through in COVID. So, unfortunately, we lost a few, and we suspect we're going to lose several more.
I would imagine, too, when they have plywood over their facades, you can't really see into the inside of the business. That must be also difficult as well, Jason, to attract customers.
Absolutely. It certainly is another challenge to the businesses downtown. Their bottom lines were so difficult to begin with. Just take a restaurant, right? Many of them, Madison has a pretty conservative COVID-19 policy, the forward Dane plan, which phases us in incrementally. And we're just starting to get into phase two, where you can open up the restaurants more. But all of a sudden, you have boards on your restaurant. That changes it significantly. So they're having to be much more creative about how they're outreaching towards their customer base. And then I will say there are some positives that are happening, particularly a program called the Streetery Program in Madison, where you use public space, either parking spaces, sidewalks, roads, even to open those up to businesses. And so they can, seat restaurant seating out there, bring out their retail racks. It allows for a more safe and healthy environment for people to congregate and really helps with one, I think, is one of the most key parts of COVID-19 is building back consumer confidence. So there are some silver linings, just as Keith mentioned, and one of those, certainly in Madison, is the Streetery program. And starting this weekend, State Street will be closed to motor vehicles from Friday to Sunday throughout the rest of the summer.
And so, with State Street being closed, does that mean that these restaurants can spill out more into the street?
Exactly. And they can use that space to really social distance properly and really open up how many people they can have in their restaurants. Even the best restaurants we were talking to that really invested very significantly in delivery and takeout were still only making up 25% of their normal revenue. And so you really do still need people coming in to the space. And we've already seen on this 100 block of South Pinckney, so right off the Capitol Square, great partners like Lucille, Merck, Settle Down Tavern, Johnny Delmonico's and Marigold have opened up a space in 14 parking spots, and it's this beautiful outdoor dining space where everyone is at least 10 feet apart, and it really creates a confident situation for people to come back downtown and enjoy our center city.
We're talking with Jason Ilstrup, president of Downtown Madison Inc., Keith Stanley here as well, executive director of Milwaukee's Near West Side Partners, about the plight of small businesses. Now, what does your business need most right now? What can state and federal lawmakers do to help you stay in business? What do you want your local customers and community members to know about your situation? How is spillover seating being done at your establishment, or how are you spacing out? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Keith, how is your organization trying to assist businesses right now? How are you reaching out?
A couple of things. First, we've decided to put together, and this is really, we just have some great folks who love working with our businesses, but we put together a program called Made in the Near West Side, hashtag Made in the Near West Side. It's basically a virtual cooking course every Wednesday, either 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, where we invite our restaurants and even some of our beverage makers to do some type of take and bake program where you can buy a meal kit or you can buy the liquor, alcohol, and try to make a drink or try to make a steak virtually at home. And it's been really successful. We've done this with Lisa K Catering, Daddy Soul Food Restaurant, Central Standard Distillery, 5 o'clock Steakhouse, even Moe's Asian Food Market. It's an Asian food market, and they put together a whole entire list of ingredients you can buy to have a fried tofu coke meal. And so we are doing that just really to use the social media and the social media platforms to encourage people to still engage our local businesses. And we're also encouraging people really to buy local when you can. And like I said earlier, it looks like there's been an uptick with some of our businesses because people want to stay away from the big box stores. And they're looking for ways just to buy local, keep it simple. Instead of having thousands upon thousands of people, they're just dealing with their local community. And we're trying to encourage that buy local scene in the city of Milwaukee.
Jason, what echoes of buy local are you working on for DMI, Downtown Madison, Inc.?
Yeah, we're working directly with our partners at Madison Central Business Improvement District, a business improvement district just like Keith, to really say you need to come downtown and buy local. So whether or not that's marketing campaigns or something we just talked about, creating consumer confidence. So helping the local businesses downtown understand what opening up a safe and healthy store means. Sure that the customers know that. So when they go into the Soap Opera or Anthology or Little Luxuries or any one of these great downtown Madison businesses, they feel safe and they feel like this is a place they can go and do their shopping, but all in a place where they're not going to be susceptible to getting COVID-19.
In the businesses that you have talked with, Jason, which ones have been said, you know, we can't do this anymore or we need to close? Is it specifically in the restaurant? Is it apparel? What sector?
Actually, unfortunately, it's been a mix of both. And it's been a mix of both, both retail and restaurants. We're seeing that some people already was relatively soft. We're 2019 or out of 2019 and into 2020. And so they're struggling now with the number of barriers and hurdles that are being placed in front of them. And so of those businesses have said, we just cannot, unfortunately, continue on. We've luckily seen less than a half dozen, but we certainly think that several more will, because we don't know what the clear plan is moving forward for this virus, right? Nobody knows. And that uncertainty really creates problems for businesses, but particularly for local small businesses.
Talking with Jason Ilstrup in Madison, Keith Stanley in Milwaukee, both working on revitalization efforts, economic development in their respective cities. Are you worried that your downtown might never be the same? Do you have a favorite business that you worry will be unable to survive these difficult times? How are you supporting them right now? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's a morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're taking stock of how Wisconsin's downtown and Main Street businesses are doing after months of the pandemic and social unrest. Are you worried your downtown might never be the same? Are you an elected official or a developer concerned that the business community will have a tough road for recovery from the pandemic? What are you trying to do to give businesses a lifeline? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We have Jason Ilstrup, president of Downtown Madison, Inc., and Keith Stanley, executive director of Milwaukee's Near West Side Partners. Keith, let's talk more about business owners in the Near West Side who are immigrants, who are people of color. There was a study found that just 7% of U.S. businesses are owned by African Americans and only 4.3% are owned by Asians. Are businesses owned by people of color, are they struggling even more than their white counterparts?
Yes, and I would say it really boils down to this. The focus area is the resources. So many of our African American owned, Hmong owned, Latinx owned businesses don't have the tax accountant, the lawyer, the connections with the banking industry to do what they need to do to survive. So when we had a couple grants come out, state grants and city grants, we're all in grant and a few others, we scrambled to really go reach out to that, to our that population and say, listen, you have to apply for these grants. This is money that will help you get through. And so we do a little more outreach and we do a little more handholding because they just don't have those connections. And so we're trying to figure out what ways we can do to improve that so they have the resources. But that is a major problem for many of our people of color business.
How established are these businesses and how much access to capital do they have?
Many of them are really first generation, just getting started, open up their first business. They've come through our business competition. We have the Rev Up business competition. We've been able to secure about over 30 businesses with that. And so many of our businesses are just really getting started. They've no more been open for no more than 5 years or less. And so they're not as established as some of the other mainline businesses we have in the Near West Side. I would say what going through this, I think, will make them stronger, will make them more resilient. Once again, a silver lining with all this. And I'm hoping that they will continue to do the things that they're doing because many of our great businesses and we want to continue to support them. They're hiring locally from the community. You know, they support things that are happening in the community, exactly what we need in the Near West Side. And I would say across this country.
Jason, how well represented are people of color among Madison's downtown businesses?
Yeah, that is an area that needs to really grow and to become even stronger. We have to become a more inclusive downtown. Right now, about 62% of the State Street businesses are either owned by people of color or by women. But there are very few businesses that are owned by Black people, and that is a real issue for downtown Madison and for many downtowns across the country. You know, groups like DMI and other people that are in power have to do everything they can to identify, confront, and dismantle those structural and cultural barriers that really deprive any individual or business of having meaningful opportunities downtown. And that means that we really do need to look at the systems that are in place now, just as Keith said, about how do we allocate resources? How do we even make those resources available to businesses owned by people of color? That's a huge issue, as he just said. You know, there might have been language barriers, there might have been accounting barriers, there could have been the ability not even to get the information to apply for these such important grants, whether or not it's PPP, WDC funding, local funding. So we have to do everything we can to support our local businesses and businesses owned by people of color now more than ever. But that's going to take structural changes. And ensuring that we're helping with every part of the system and every part of that entrepreneurial pipeline to get businesses down there to support things like the Market Ready program here in Madison, where they take entrepreneurs from the ground up in businesses that could easily be in bricks and mortar locations in downtown Madison and really get them all of the knowledge and services they need to succeed as a business in infancy and then grow into something that can become a brick and mortar store.
We're looking at the Main Street health of businesses in Wisconsin, in Madison and Milwaukee in particular. Jason Ilstrup, president of Downtown Madison, Inc., DMI, and Keith Stanley, executive director of Milwaukee's Near West Side Partners. I want to ask you both, as we look at the protests in both Madison and Milwaukee that have led to property damage along State Street, Jason, and Madison, many storefronts were smashed during the protest. Tell us about what the mood is like among business owners on State Street right now.
Yeah, you know, so many of the business owners support the protests, and they were really encouraged to see what was happening. This is potentially was a time for real change, real structural and institutional change. You know, however, though, they certainly received a high amount of property damage during from the protest and the rioting. And about 100 to 125 of the 150 businesses on State Street received some sort of damage. And so they are really in kind of an apprehensive phase right now about what's going to happen next in the future. Things have calmed down very nicely in Madison over the last week or so. But because they don't know what the future looks like, they're still pretty apprehensive, and the businesses don't fully know when to, like we discussed earlier, take down their boards or fully open for business. Plus, you cannot discount, you know, the large part of this conversation in COVID-19. They don't know fully what their business looks like in a COVID-19 environment. And as we all know, the testing has gone up and the numbers seem to be going in a wrong direction. And so there's a lot of apprehension in many of the business owners throughout State Street and downtown.
Keith, there were protests on the near west side of Milwaukee as well. What was the impact in your district?
Well, a couple of things I want to share. One, the majority of our protests, I don't think there were really one official protest that was not peaceful, which we really appreciate. We even had the opportunity to have some of the Bucks players join us on 27th in Wisconsin and 35th in Wisconsin. So it's really nice to see. Out of all the things that occurred in our city, we had about 5 buildings that were affected. And we're now working to make sure those buildings the windows are cleaned up and the graffiti and everything is removed. Ultimately, we weren't as affected as some of the other bids in neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee. I think that our businesses were really open to understanding the struggle and the plight specifically of African-American people. And it was really heartwarming to see many of our businesses stand with the protesters. We even had some of our larger anchor institutions, Advocate Aurora Health, Marquette University, really stand in support. And so that was really heartwarming. I think it is a challenge for many of our businesses because many, you know, they're, like I said earlier, there's smaller businesses trying to get their footholds on the ground and they struggle. And so when things like this happen where people can't shop, can't buy, or there's property damage, you know, of course, if they're a small business owner, they're concerned. But for the most part, most of our businesses have been open to getting the help they need to clean up some of the damage that occurred. But ultimately, we weren't affected like other communities in the city of Milwaukee.
Keith, you know, as Jason said, the numbers going in the wrong direction and businesses really trying to negotiate such a challenging, tricky time about reopening and how to go about it. What gives you hope?
I would say this is going to sound really, really crazy, so hopefully I can go with me. But I mean, if you look at the Great Depression, that's McDonald's was birthed in the vacuum cleaner and Monopoly was birthed out of the Great Depression in the late 1920s. And I just think this is the time where we encourage our businesses to think outside the box. Online sales is going through the roof, as we can see with groups like Amazon and others. And so we're working with our businesses to figure out what ways can you position yourself where people can still get your goods and services, but not necessarily through your store. Jason mentioned about earlier about opening up the streets. That's something we're exploring. We have a couple green lots that vacant green lots we're exploring to get people outside for more space. I think this is the time when thinking outside the box, no matter how cliche it sounds, being creative is really important. So we're trying to encourage our businesses don't think traditionally. So it encourages me that when we hear our businesses are thinking outside the box, that gives me hope.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Jason Ilstra, president of the advocacy organization Downtown Madison, Inc. Keith Stanley, executive director of Near West Side Partners and Milwaukee's Business Improvement District Number 10. Just ahead, it is On Point. Who should Joe Biden select as his running mate? It's an assessment of his short list of candidates. That's On Point. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.